at Safari.
Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
Welcome to the program. I hope you've had a fulfilling week since we spoke last and are happy and healthy. We are going to continue our discussion of the text Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun. But first, let's set our motivation for today's program, as we do for all our programs. What is the best motivation? Well, I hope you said bodhicitta, the wish to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, because certainly from a Mahayana point of view, that is the greatest. The reason being that the object of the wish, that is, all beings, is very vast. So the motivation is also vast. If we benefit five beings, that is obviously five times better than benefiting only one being. So if we benefit countless beings, it is countless times more beneficial than only benefiting one being. In fact, the positive potential we get from a real heartfelt commitment to bodhicitta is said to be huge. So, if we can make even just the aspiration to attain enlightenment to best help all others, we accumulate tremendous positive potential. However, if that is just too big an ask, then it's okay. Set a motivation for your own liberation from all suffering. Thank you. Now back to Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun. We are discussing how to develop bodhicitta, and if you remember, the Tibetans use two methods, the seven cause and effect method and the exchanging self for others method. We have come to the second, the exchanging self for others method. We have considered the disadvantages of self-cherishing and the advantages of cherishing others, and are now on the section entitled Actually Cultivating the Awakening Mind Concerned with the Interest of Others. And this is divided into two sections, meditation on love and meditation on compassion. In our last program, we continued with the meditation on love, particularly looking at what real love is. We ended the program with the Tibetan definition, which says love is the wish to bring happiness, primarily, of course, to others, but also to ourselves. For if we cannot love ourselves, how can we possibly even say we love others? In this section of Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, the author Namkha Pal quotes three verses from Nagarjuna's precious garland that go, even giving 300 delicacies three times every day to monks would not equal a part of the merit of even one moment of love. You will be loved by gods and men, and they will also offer you protection. You will experience mental ecstasy and much happiness, and poisons and weapons will do you no harm. You will effortlessly achieve your purpose and could be born in Brahma's realm even if you have not attained liberation. Through love, the eight spiritual qualities are attained. Namkha Pal writes in his commentary, if you have love, gods and men will gather together under its force. Even the conqueror Buddha defeated the malevolent forces of Mara through the power of love. Therefore, it is the supreme protection, and so forth. You might wonder about the source of the explanation for meditation on love through giving away your body, wealth, and virtue. It is to be found in Shantideva's Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life, in the chapter concerning acceptance of the awakening mind in a formal ceremony. When the ceremony of actual acceptance is over, just before the actual pledges are recited, as the preceptor is describing the visualization of love and compassion, you should give away your body, possessions, and sources of virtue. Now you may remember that we quoted a little from His Holiness the Dalai Lama's commentary in our last program, where he says, as for giving to others, there's giving our body, giving our wealth, giving the roots of our positive potentials so that they will ripen on others. The source of this is the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. As a practice of giving away our body, we first pray for inspiration. Then we think of the beings in various joyless realms, such as the reviving hells, or others in the hot hells and so forth. And we think of changing our body into cooling rain, for instance. Basically, we think of whatever those beings need to relieve their suffering. For the thirsty, we change into something to slake their thirst. For the hungry, something to satisfy their hunger. We change our body into whatever is needed by the beings in the joyless realms and take on the suffering of their disastrous situation. To stabilize this, we change our body into all the various positive qualities they will need to reach enlightenment, such as the seven Arya gems. Mind training, like the rays of the sun, goes into quite a lot of detail about who to give to and how to give. It introduces a section on how to give your body, possessions, and virtues in general, and then goes on to list in particular how to give to various sections of the universal community. First, it talks about giving to those not on the spiritual path, then to those who are harmful to us, those engaged in the spiritual path, and finally, giving to the environment. And that covers how to give your body. Then the text explains giving away possessions, and finally, giving away virtues. In the first section, Namkha Pal says that the purpose of giving body, possessions, and virtues in a general sense is to complete the two collections of merit and wisdom. This means to accumulate all the causes for Buddhahood, including being able to give away everything, including our body and positive potentials. We need two things: a huge amount of merit or positive potential, and infinite wisdom. Merit we accumulate, paradoxically, by giving away all our merit. The more you give, the more you get, so as to speak. And wisdom, where generosity is concerned, is developed by giving with the right attitude and point of view. In terms of attitude, that means giving without the slightest wish for a reward or thanks, and no miserliness, which also includes that sneaking, almost psychologically subterranean desire to keep the gift or offering. You know, that tiny vapor of a desire wishing to keep the gift for oneself. The point of view comes from recognizing that the giver, the act of giving, and the recipient are all empty of any inherent independent existence. Whatever we give and whoever we give to, we should have the understanding that it is all just a coming together of causes, conditions, and parts with a labeling of the mind. There is no real independent person giving, no real independent act of giving, and no real independent person receiving. No I, no giving, and no you. Only process, and even that is not independent. In a real sense, we should really experience this. It shouldn't be just a conceptual idea. But that is very difficult. So at this stage, we need to try to understand it, at least intellectually. And that is all we can try to do. Namkha Pal quotes a verse from the Bodhisattva's Way of Life that goes, "I will give away without restriction my body, possessions, and the virtue I have produced in the three times to accomplish the welfare of all beings." Without restriction means, as we've discussed, that all miserliness or any wish for a reward or even a thank you should not even come within spitting distance of our mind. And the purpose, Shantideva urges, is for the welfare of all beings. That is, not only immediate welfare, like enough food, shelter, and warmth, but ongoing welfare right until every being is free from all suffering whatsoever and becomes Buddha. Also notice that the virtue he talks about is not only that which we get in this life, but all that we have already collected, are creating right now, and will create in the future. Then continuing, Namkha Pal writes that it is actually not suitable to give our body as it is. He says, "From among these, meaning body, possessions, and virtue, it is generally inappropriate to give away the body, because it consists of unclean substances such as flesh and blood." Well, now, this may seem a little odd, because for one thing, from a wisdom point of view, we cannot apply clean or unclean to the human body and all its substances. Clean and unclean come purely from a conventional viewpoint, and what may appear as unclean to one view may appear as clean to another. For instance, I doubt that a hungry tiger would see my body, and especially my flesh and blood, as unclean. The more hungry it is, the more desirable the blood and guts will be. Unless, I guess, the tiger knows about the uncleanliness of flesh and blood, but is still compelled by karma to consume it, which I somehow doubt. Thus, if we think about it, much of what appears as unclean in the human body is the result of a conventional and often provisional point of view. However, when we practice generosity to the Buddhas and other highly realized beings, the body may well be an inappropriate offering. Not because the high beings think our body is repulsive, but because we have such ambivalent attitudes towards it. Sometimes we think the body is disgusting, at other times delightful, isn't it so? My sister is a very ardent Christian, as I've already mentioned in these programs before, and has told me what an incredible and admirable thing the human body is. That is partly because God created it. But if I sneezed in the morning at breakfast, I don't think she would react favorably at all to those bits of my body that land on her toast. This is the dilemma we all face to one extent or the other, and I mention my sister not as a criticism of her or Christianity, but because our ambivalent view of the body is accentuated when it is seen as an object of awe. But I guess that whether we offer it and how we do so depends on how we view it. There's even one practice in Tibetan Buddhism called chur that offers the body all ground up and gorish in an overturned skull to the various monstrous eaters of flesh that exist outside of our human sensory experience. Presumably, chur practitioners offer their body, flesh, blood, and all the rest, to those who find such things delightful. There certainly seems to be little point in offering it all to those who find it repulsive. In any case, all you who are really keen to offer your body but see it and its substances as unclean or repulsive, don't despair. Namkha Pel's instructions show you how you can do it. He quotes the Array of Tree Trunk Sutra, which says, "You should transform yourself into a wish-fulfilling body that sustains all wandering beings," and the Sutra of the Vajra Victory Banner, "just as through various means and through the various manifestations, the four great elements sustain all sentient beings, a bodhisattva transforms his own body so that it is the basis for sustaining all sentient beings." What does this mean? Well, it is as His Holiness says, we can visualize dissolving our body into all the things beings need and offering it to them in this way. That included transforming the body into pure offerings for the highly realized beings. The Array of Tree Trunk Sutra gives one way of doing this. Think of your body as a kind of Father Christmas without the ridiculous outfit and reindeer. This Santa is wandering about looking for children, that is, ordinary sentient beings, to help and give helpful stuff too. But Santa doesn't have a big bag containing all beings' presents. He himself is the bag. He gives of himself continuously and unrelentingly. So this bag is infinitely deep, and though you could keep on pulling stuff out of it, it doesn't get any emptier. And this is how we are encouraged to transform our body into something that fulfills the wishes of other beings. Namkha Pel quotes verses from chapter 3 of the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, the chapter on commitment. The verses go, "During the intermediate eon of famine, may I become food and drink for sentient beings who are poor and famished. May I remain in their presence as various necessities. And also, may I protect those without protection and be a guide leading those upon the path. May I become a vessel, a bridge, and a ship for those who wish to cross over the ocean. May I be an island for those searching for land, and a lamp for those needing a light. May I become a bed for those who need rest, and a servant for all who want assistance. May I become accomplishing mantras and excellent vases, fabulous wish-fulfilling trees, and great elements such as the earth. May I be the basis of sustenance for limitless sentient beings, existing eternally for them like space. In this way, just as all realms of sentient beings are infinite like the expanse of the sky, may I become the basis for their sustenance until they all attain the state beyond sorrow." As you can see, this is pretty comprehensive. It means turning our body not only to the things that beings need in their daily lives, but also everything they need to become enlightened. These verses are, of course, about generosity. But do you feel the love that is behind them, the wish for others to have whatever brings them happiness? As we saw earlier in the program, the greatest thing to give is love. And so how wonderful if at its best, our generosity is an expression of unconditional love. Namgyal Pal now goes on to pull a quote from a Sangha's Spiritual Levels of the Bodhisattva that explains how Bodhisattvas take generosity even further. It reads, "Bodhisattvas who have gone into solitude and have gathered their thoughts inwardly should purify their thoughts of selfishness, and from the bottom of their hearts, with sincere faith, should practice generosity out of their concern for all, imagining a limitless, huge and expansive variety of things, as well as providing sentient beings with actual gifts. In doing so, a bodhisattva will expand his accumulations of merit limitlessly and with little hardship. This is a practice for bodhisattvas who are endowed with great intelligence." Now, of course, we shouldn't do any practice of generosity for the sake of increasing our merit or positive potential, whether exponentially or otherwise. Our only motivation must be love and the benefit of others. And in fact, as we have found earlier, we are even supposed to give away our merit as well. It is good to know that through such vast visualizations, our merit expands so much, but only because it means we have more merit to give away. Otherwise, we become just like profit-driven investors or bankers. Talking about financial dealers, recently on a website, Spirituality and Practice, that is www.spiritualityandpractice.com, I came across an article on the spiritual practice of generosity. It's actually a collection of what spiritual teachers have had to say about giving, but the introduction is pretty inspiring. It goes like this. Warren Buffett, one of the world's richest men, announced in June 2006 that he was giving 85% of his fortune to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to help the foundation pursue its long-standing goal of curing the globe's most fatal diseases and improving American education. This is a $31 billion gift, certainly one of the largest acts of generosity in world history. Two thoughts came to mind when we heard this news. First, we recalled something Bill Gates, chairman of the Microsoft Corporation, said 3 years ago. It came near the end of an interview with Bill Moyers on the BBC series Now. Moyers and Gates were discussing his philanthropic activities, and Gates recounted a litany of reasons why some people think addressing global health problems is a good idea. Some use economic arguments. If we cure something like malaria in an African country, say, then that country's gross national product will be higher, and presumably they will buy more things. Some use security arguments. If we don't cure these diseases, the instability in these countries will be bad. Others use the neighborhood arguments. Somebody could get on a plane from one of these places, and you might get sick. None of these arguments, Gates said matter-of-factly, is the right one. The right argument is this mother's child is sick, and that child's life is no less valuable than the life of anyone else, and the world has plenty of resources to go solve these problems. We have never forgotten that statement. On the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation website, they restate it as the two simple values that lie at the core of the foundation's work. One, all lives, no matter where they are being led, have equal value. Two, to whom much has been given, much is expected. The second thought that came to mind when we heard of Warren Buffett's gift is that generosity is for everyone. If this is how we honor and express human value, then any act of kindness counts in the bigger picture. We can all be kind. We can all be generous. This is one of the key teachings of all the world's religions. You can share even if you have a little, according to a Lungunden East African proverb. The webpage continues with a list of quotes from various spiritual teachers, like this from Wendy Lustbader, a mental health counselor writing in her book, Counting on Kindness. The words genius and generous come from the word Latin root genere, meaning to beget. To have a genius for life is to possess the ability to generate warmth and well-being in others. Largesse literally enlarges our lives. Or this from editor Rebecca Laird, quoting in the book The Heart of Henri Nouwen from Nouwen's Catholic book Sabbatical Journey. I think that generosity has many levels. We have to think generously, speak generously, and act generously. Thinking well of others and speaking well of others is the basis for generous giving. It means that we relate to others as part of our gen or kin and treat them as family. Generosity cannot come from guilt or pity. It has to come from hearts that are fearless and free and are willing to share abundantly all that is given to us. Nouwen, incidentally, was a Catholic contemplative. Another quote comes from the book Love Dharma, in which author Jerry Larkin states, "The Buddha taught over and over that generosity is the first door we walk through if we are serious about our spiritual work. Without generosity, enlightenment is flat out impossible. We're too self-centered. Unless our relationships are bathed in generosity, they don't have a chance. At the other extreme, generosity can buttress a faulting relationship, giving other parameters time to work their magic. It fuels the little extras, the surprise moments that keep us fresh and interesting." And finally, the renowned Buddhist spiritual teacher Joseph Epstein has a take on giving and consumerism in Hooked, a book of various Buddhist writings on greed and desire, edited by Stephanie Kaza. Did you see the movie Wall Street, in which the corporate raider Gordon Gekko made the famous greed is good speech? The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good, he said, addressing the shareholders of a large but failing corporation. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind. Well, do you agree? Joseph Epstein doesn't. He writes, "The practice of generosity can serve as a corrective to addictive consumerism. Generosity enacts the quality of non-greed. It is a willingness to share, to let go. It may be giving of time, energy, resources, love, and even in rare cases, one's own life for the benefit and welfare of others. Generosity weakens the tendency of attachment and grasping and is intimately connected with a feeling of loving kindness. People who experience the power and joy of generosity will also experience its effect on consuming. The cultivation of generosity offers a very strong antidote to the wanting mind and would be a powerful corrective if taken up in a widespread way across our culture." Obviously, Gordon Gekko was not at all interested in enlightenment, but enlightenment is Joseph Epstein's raison d'etre, and the results, I think, speak for themselves, notwithstanding that Gordon Gekko was a fictional character. To migrate to the opposite end of the greed spectrum, Khalil Gibran makes a beautiful summary of The Art of Giving in The Prophet, that go-to book of wisdom for me and all the hippies of my youth. This may therefore bring back memories for those of you who lived with long hair and a colorful peasant fashion in the middle of the last century. It goes thus, "Then said a rich man, speak to us of giving. And he answered, you give but little when you give of your possessions. It is when you give of yourself that you truly give. For what are your possessions but things you keep and guard for fear you may need them tomorrow? And tomorrow, what shall tomorrow bring to the overprudent dog bearing bones in the trackless sand as he follows the pilgrims to the holy city? And what is fear of need but need itself? Is not dread of thirst when your well is full, thirst that is unquenchable? There are those who give little of the much which they have, and they give it for recognition, and their hidden desire makes their gifts unwholesome. And there are those who have little and give it all. These are the believers in life and the bounty of life, and their coffer is never empty. There are those who give with joy, and that joy is their reward. And there are those who give with pain, and that pain is their baptism. And there are those who give and know not pain in giving, nor do they seek joy, nor give with mindfulness of virtue. They give as in yonder valley the myrtle breathes its fragrance into space. Through the hands of such as these, God speaks, and from behind their eyes, he smiles upon the earth. It is well to give when asked, but it is better to give unasked through understanding. And to the open-handed, the search for one who shall receive is joy greater than giving. And is there aught you would withhold? All you have shall someday be given. Therefore, give now, that the season of giving may be yours and not your inheritors. You often say, I would give, but only to the deserving. The trees in your orchard say not so, nor the flocks in your pasture. They give that they may live, for to withhold is to perish. Surely he who is worthy to receive his days and his nights is worthy of all else from you. And he who has deserved to drink from the ocean of life deserves to fill his cup from your little stream. And what desert greater shall there be than that which lies in the courage and the confidence, nor the charity of receiving? And who are you that men should rend their bosom and unveil their pride, that you may see their worth naked and their pride unabashed? See first that you yourself deserve to be a giver and an instrument of giving. For in truth, it is life that gives unto life, while you who deem yourself a giver are but a witness. And you receivers, and you are all receivers, assume no weight of gratitude, lest you lay a yoke upon yourself and upon him who gives. Rather, rise together with the giver on his gifts as on wings. For to be overmindful of your debt is to doubt his generosity, who has the free-hearted earth for mother and God for father. Isn't that extraordinary? And that's what I will leave you with for the week, as we have come to the end of our time together today. Have a glorious week of giving, and I hope you will join us again next time. Please dedicate any positive energy from this program to gaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Thank you, and goodbye.